to another edition of the Clement End podcast. We are so delighted to be back together, albeit virtually, ready to record another podcast, bringing together some fantastic ideas and reflections of what has been a real roller coaster of a year. Emma, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I mean, the children are back. Our children are back in school. I know, after 109 days of online learning, 109 days of comedy moments in online learning. Have you had any comedy moments? I found it's been ludicrous at times.
It won't surprise you to know there have been many mishaps and misdemeanors. Particular favorite, I think, was when I host an online drop-in session for all of our parents every Thursday evening, and my dear friend and deputy head Alistair produces it for me. Obviously not a patch on Rav. And I thought we weren't live yet. The red box wasn't there. I was bemoaning my appalling lockdown hair and taking the point to really show it right to the camera, really picking out those split ends and scraggly bits, only to find out the whole thing had gone out live and also the recorded link sent out to 310 parents. So that was a low point for me. How about you?
Well, we've had, I mean, it's mainly through the children, actually. And I do love lurking in the background while they're on their online calls. And there's nothing worse you can do.
Like you. Why are you doing that to us?
Oh, because it's joyful. Their teachers have done so brilliantly, honestly, watching them just adapt with their humor and their good naturedness to the absolute, you know, shit show that is technology. But, you know, the worst thing you can do to an 11-year-old, apparently, is bomb their meetings and run in and say, "Hello, Mrs. Smith. Yeah. How is everybody today?
This is true.
We also, the eldest came down absolutely gleeful. Apparently, and I couldn't name him for love nor money, but apparently a very famous YouTuber decided it would be a laugh to ask young people to share their links to their online lessons. And he spent a good few days just dropping in. Dropping into random geography and French lessons across the country. And this YouTuber actually came into one of my daughter's lessons. She was absolutely delighted. And the poor teacher, this 20-something suddenly appears in the corner of their lesson.
I heard of a local school where they were on Zoom, I think, and all the children changed their names on the Zoom call to a famous footballer who plays for the team that their teacher absolutely hated. And then they all morphed their voices and started singing quite rude football songs about his chosen team, which again I thought was magic. I do love children's ingenuity. I think they've learned very quickly how to work teams out. We've had a few that learned quite early on how to do some really clever tricks, so we've had to catch up with them, but it's been the most phenomenal learning curve, and I think there's so much we can take from it and build forward in a positive way.
But it has been spectacularly challenging as well. I mean, one of the things I do is work with new teachers, so people who are brand new to the profession. What a time to choose, eh? And I actually found myself on a conversation 2 weeks ago with a wonderful hardworking trainee who said, "I need to work on TS5 TS5 is meeting the needs of all learners. So I need to show evidence that I'm meeting the needs of all of these learners whilst I'm teaching this romantic poetry." And I said, "Right, okay, so let's go back to square one. What can you tell me about them?" And she said, "I've never met them. They're a new class from January.
God.
Timetables changed." And I said, "Okay, all right. Oh, well, okay, so where are you at? Tell me about your setup." And she said, "Well, for safeguarding reasons, all cameras are off." It's like, you've never met them. You
never
can't see their faces. And you have to show that you're meeting all their needs. And when you just think about some of these conversations that we're having, and she did it, you know, she did it. She found ways of using the chat box and smiley faces and sad faces to indicate their levels of confidence and
breakout rooms.
Yes.
So breakout rooms are a takeaway gift from me to our fellow educators. They are the best way to group children up and do collaboration. The only downside, which I found out to my own detriment, is that somehow I managed to lose myself in a call. So all of my children in a breakout room, I'm lost somewhere on the internet. And I can just hear this lone voice going, "Miss Stewart would want us to carry on without her. She would believe in us. We just need to get on and do this for her." And I was crying out to my computer, "I'm not dead. I'm still here. I'm just somewhere in a breakout room." But they do work brilliantly, in all seriousness.
I mean, it's also, you know, it's just so surreal. So it was around this time last year that a colleague of mine contacted me and made a joke about someone hearing from their school that they were going to close from Monday because of the pandemic. And it was a joke, and we rolled around laughing. Why would such a thing happen? And now we're going into school, sticking a cotton bud up our noses.
Yeah. and down our throat.
Just as a matter of course.
Make sure you get in the right order.
Oh, trying not to retch. And you know what? I mean, you know, mainstream secondary schools are doing 180 kids in a day. And I spoke to a group of middle leaders the other day and said, oh, how on earth are you doing that? Because I'm in alternative provision. So we've got lovely small groups.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, it was all right in the end. We were a bit
worried. It's
amazing.
It's amazing.
The bloody resilience. The adaptability.
My senior school, you know, they were doing 180 girls in the space of a few hours. And I went in and helped last weekend because we wanted to get them all done before they could come back to school, have their first test before they came back. And these, you know, teenage kids, again, just, you know, scraping the backs of their throats. And I'm coming out with phrases like, don't worry, it's perfectly normal to gag, keep going. Or tickle it, almost it's painful, but not quite. And if you sneeze, you know, just do the best you can. And then they're handing me back, you know, the swab in a pot saying, thank you so much, Miss Stewart. And I was thinking, it's really the pleasure is not all mine, but they're just so resilient. And I think if anything that we can celebrate from the last year is just how incredibly resilient our children are, our staff are, the things we've learned to do, the speed with which we've learned to do it. I just think it is truly, truly phenomenal. And there are so many positives we can take from it.
Absolutely. And yes, there are challenges ahead. And yes, we will talk about and we'll examine those in detail in future pods. But at the moment, I suppose the big thing is they're back. It did make me laugh, though. There was this outpouring of love and affection on Twitter on Monday and Tuesday, you know, just people saying how overjoyed they were to see their students again. And there was this great tweet from a year 10, male year 10 teacher, science teacher, I think. And he said, I just took a moment to stand and gaze at them as they chatted and laughed amongst themselves until a student turned around and said, why are you being so weird, sir? just think, you know, and to me, that tweet was everything there is to love about teenagers. Sir, stop being so weird.
Yeah, why are you staring at us?
Why are you gazing at us? And you know, actually, our PTA did a lovely thing. So we decided that we cannot possibly be asking parents for money at the moment. You know, we know the challenges parents are facing, but it was our role to bring some joy to the local school. I don't know if you did this, so we actually arranged a balloon arch and music.
Yes.
And
of
I must
course
say,
I did.
You did the balloon arch too. I bet you did. I bet you out balloon arched us, didn't you? We had bubbles.
Did you have green and silver? No, but I had a welcome back banner.
Bubbles.
It was cut out letter by letter. And I had critical worker children who, without being asked, had gone around and left a note on every classroom door saying, we're so glad to have you back.
Oh,
I know.
Oh, but the critical worker children weren't they? Because it had almost become, in many schools, almost two camps, the children at home and the children at school. And there was a real sense that you know, they'd become very different entities. And in our daughter's school, they actually allowed the key worker children to decide on the seating plan for the return to school. And just the sheer excitement of being back together again has just been, you know, effervescent and brilliant.
It's been so special. And I think what, you know, it was lovely to take stock on Monday, Tuesday, celebrate. And it did feel like a mini party, albeit in socially distanced bubbles, I hasten to add. But now the dust is settling. It is a bit like a snow globe. We've given it a big shake and all the bits are now flaking down to the bottom. And I think we need to now look with really, really fresh eyes at the children in front of us and what's happened to them.
Yeah, so other than really bad haircuts, either shorn at home or ridiculously long, how are you finding that your children have changed? Because it's been a long time.
It's really interesting. They've become very, very focused on their learning. I mean, they were before, but they became very insular learners and I think quite enjoyed that. So coming back into a big, loud classroom has taken quite a lot of adjustment. They all want to speak when they want to speak. They're quite used to just getting on their own, and it's taken a little while for them to just get used to being part of a bigger group again. They're enjoying it and they're loving it, but it's just we've had to reestablish some of those basic routines that perhaps I wouldn't have thought we would have needed to, but it's been fine to do that. We've built in time to make sure we could do that. I think we're also being really mindful of the ones who quite enjoyed being at home and quite enjoyed a different pace of school life, and just thinking about how we can broach that for them, because schools are busy and vibrant and noisy. And for some, that's great. For others, it's a bit of a sensory overload. And it's just making sure that we're mindful of that. But most of mine are really quite almost dismissive. They're like, yeah, we learned at home and now we're back at school. And they seem at the moment to be really quite chilled about the whole thing, but I'm not going to make assumptions that that will last forever. I'm going to keep an eye on that very proactively.
And what I'm hearing from a lot of teachers is that that honeymoon period that we had after the summer hasn't happened this time. And I think it's partly because it's been so sudden, the return back.
Yeah.
And because children have coped in so many different ways. And there have been, you know, actually, I don't think we talk about behavior enough. A lot of teachers are very, very worried about children's behavior at the moment.
Interesting.
Because a lot of children will have had, you know, even in the most comfortable and stable of houses, very different boundaries or almost no boundaries at all. And a lot of people are very worried about children's behavior. We're already starting to get stories about children falling out with one another very quickly. And I think it's a combination of fear and exhaustion and insecurity. It's how, given that how tired people are, how they then can tweak their tried and tested strategies to make sure that they're, that I suppose they're coping with this upheaval.
I mean, I think one thing I thought was really interesting and really resonated with me on Twitter over the last few weeks was staff saying it feels like the end of term. So that Friday, the 5th of March, you know, people felt like they were breaking up. Homeschool was definitely breaking up, but it wasn't breaking up. It was a weekend. And then we all came back on the Monday and I had my staff saying, this is a bit like coming back from an inset. This is so weird. But it wasn't. It was just another part of the term. And I think if it had been the beginning of term, we would have done all of that establishing golden rules, you know, our class rules, discussions about routines and behavior. That I think going back now, it's really worth having those conversations if you haven't already, just resetting that almost like it's September. So how are we going to work as a class? How are we going to listen to each other? How are we going to treat each other? And then having lots of staff around and available on the playground at lunchtimes to just help navigate some of those social things you're talking about.
Let's just cut the narrative around gaps and cut the narrative around catch up. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that narrative, but I just find that it almost provokes all my reptilian instincts and it's not what it's about at all, is it?
It's not. And I find it really uncomfortable. And I'm going to say this as carefully as I can, because I can see how it might get misconstrued. But, you know, people who listen to this know that I'm head of an independent school. And so I'm acutely aware that not only in this lockdown, but the last lockdown, our children still had all of their curriculum subjects. They had lessons right the way through. And whilst I'm not saying for a second it replicated a normal school life, in terms of their curriculum and in terms of their progress, they are where they need to be. They're where we predicted they would be. They're where we would expect them to be. And so what I'm so fearful and uncomfortable about is that yawning attainment gap. And I think the more that we talk about it, the worse that's going to get. And I think if I'm a child sat there thinking, I didn't get online learning, I need to catch up, I'm really behind. You know, no year four child needs to think that they are behind or part of a lost generation. We have to change the narrative around it.
And as parents, we've been really careful with our two to say to them that, you know, when we ask you how your day's been, we're not asking you whether you've mastered Pythagoras yet. We're not asking you whether you've remembered what a fronted adverbial is. We're asking you how you're feeling, how your relationships with your friends, and, you know, and because actually we know this, the worst thing you can do with young people is make them feel inadequate. It's Maslow, isn't it? It's a very basic, you know, you're not good enough. What can we do about this? And we know from our education system that just throwing more at children, so summer schools, longer school days, all of that narrative, just throwing more makes no difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's about the quality of what they do have. And those children who have been, for whatever reason, disengaged with school or with the online learning, it's just getting them in, getting them having conversations, having a cup of tea. Taking them on their own terms and celebrating the things that are important to them. So you may have had silver balloons, Clementine, but I had an albino snail yesterday. One of my students, total surprise to all of us. No one knew this was going to happen. One of our beautiful young people brought her albino snail to school.
We were just having
our morning cup of tea together, as we always do in AP, because we all start the day together with a cup of tea.
Love
and we
that.
Turned around and she was washing her snail under the tap in the kitchen sink. I'm not sure where
that on your risk assessment.
Yes, exactly. And then, but what was so wonderful is that this is a young lady who has struggled with relationships. She was queen for the day because everyone wanted to touch the snail, but she had to go through the full snail touching risk assessment with them.
Love that.
And they were only allowed to touch the snail if they were wearing the blue gloves and had wet hands already. And they knew that when it retracted its they called ear, those thing, antennae. I don't know.
Sorry, do you teach science?
It is antennae. I mean, anyway, if it retracts its things, it means that it's a bit stressed. But it came right out of its shell along with its owner. And we had, yes. So so it is, I mean, you can hear it in my voice. It's so wonderful to have them back. And sometimes actually with children who have had unmet needs, who have had massive gaps, just sitting down and having a conversation with them about the hamster, actually animals, always animals, about the hamster, about the dog, about the cats, about the snail. That on its own is to be celebrated and is a huge success.
Definitely. And I think that teachers and parents alike just need to be really precise in their questioning and thoughtful in their questioning. I think talk is going to be so important over the coming weeks and months between home and school, between children and parents, children and teachers. But it's just being open and neutral in that questioning, not were you worried about going to school or what was your biggest concern? But actually, what was on your mind when you walked to school? Yeah, exactly. What was on your mind? I had a year one parent handed his daughter over to me on Monday and he said, look, I don't know what she means by this, but she said her tummy is just a bit inside out and back to front. And I said, well, I think she speaks for all of us. You know, everyone feels a bit that way. And just tell me about your tummy. Why does it feel that way? And what's in your mind? Just being really open and neutral so children can talk without us placing our own fears and anxieties on our young people. Because I worry that sometimes the narrative in the media and from some, you know, cross-party politicians is very, very focused on that negative catch up, lost generation, lost earnings. I'd love to know more about how they calculated those lost earnings. But actually, kids hear that, kids pick it up, parents pick it up, and it just becomes a self-perpetuating cycle, which we just don't need. Let's focus on what skills our children have learned, what skills our teachers have learned, how that's going to shape the curriculum. There's some really exciting work going on with the Fed Council, people looking at the future of education and the purpose of education. Let's build on that positivity rather than just talking about lost learning.
Well, talking of amazing skills, should we have a guest, Clem?
I think we should.
We are delighted to welcome an actual young person. We've spent lots of our time talking to people who are a little bit long in the tooth with about their opinions about schools and education. We wanted to talk to someone who's recently been at the chalk face. So we are delighted to welcome the sickeningly brilliant Alfie Payne. Alfie is the founder and managing director of Ape Technology, a ridiculously successful company. He's going to tell us a little bit about that, about his decision to leave college, about how the system ultimately both enriched him and ultimately let him down. And we are very pleased to have you today, Alfie. Welcome.
Thanks, Emma. What an introduction.
Alfie, you've obviously achieved a huge amount in what is a relatively short period of time. What do you attribute that success to? Tell us your story.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the pandemic, obviously every business organisation needed to be online in ways not before, whether that was the remote working technologies or having to, you know, a cafe having to reach its audience online because it didn't have a high street presence anymore. It started off being that businesses couldn't afford to pay the sort of thousands of pounds that you would to other consultants and agencies, but they could interact with little old Alfie or little young Alfie. And so that sort of carried on. That went quite well. And all of a sudden there was more work than just one person could do, because simultaneous to this, obviously I was doing remote learning and getting to grips with all of that. Mm. So it went on from there. And then I brought people along with me. And we have got to the point where we are now, coming up to sort of at the end of our financial year, the 31st of March, we're looking to have grossed 40,000. We've just opened our creative hub, which is really exciting, which is sort of like a collaborative working space. I employ 7 people, and we've worked with over 50 brands in 3 countries, all of which has been achieved on a bootstrap basis, which in non-business terms means we've had no investor. It's been as a result of our sales. And also we've done no paid advertising campaigns, much to the dismay of my media manager. So all of our all of our sales and stuff comes from word of mouth, which is really exciting for us.
That's brilliant, Alfie. So that's a hell of a leap then from school life to that scale of business. When did the business bug set in for you?
I've never studied or never taken a business class or anything like that. I didn't engage particularly well with the PHSC program at school. But you know, where you would learn all those enterprise skills. But now I sort of have fantastic support bubbles around me and fantastic people to help out.
Are there any aspects of school life that you feel did prepare you for that, or do you feel you've done it in spite of your education?
What I did learn in school was those core skills of how to negotiate a situation, how to lead people, how to manage expectations, how to interact, how to manage my own workload, all that sort of thing. And I think for me, that was the important takeaway that I got from secondary education, as opposed to those sort of hard skills to turn into a career. And I suppose potentially that's because I've started now an FE, you know, after an FE experience rather than after a HE degree experience.
So when you say core skills, Alfie, what do you mean? You talked about core skills from school.
I think it's the core people skills. I always find that what's really interesting is clients always say, Alfie, you have the technical skills, but also you've got the people ability and you've got the people skills. And I think it's those people skills, that learning how to navigate certain experiences, how to appropriately word an email and, you know, to set the tone for that is what's sort of, those sort of core communication interpersonal ability skills is what's important. A lot of people sometimes don't engage necessarily very well with the classroom environment, with worksheets, with homework, but what they're doing is interacting. What happens in school is safe, and it's safe to make those mistakes and to learn how to do things, which, you know, if that happened in the business world, it just wouldn't be good at all. And it's not good in school, but you get the point I'm trying to make.
I totally agree. In school, you make hundreds of mistakes and it's celebrated and it's great. The business world, I can only imagine, is much less forgiving. So how have you bridged that? And have you come across any barriers, you know, particularly around your age or how people perceive that bridge that you've crossed?
It's knowing that you have to be quite stubborn, really.
Yeah.
And something I find about the education community, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's in real life, is that people are approachable and people want to engage with you and want to help you. That's not always the case. And in fact, that's not the norm for the business industry, I don't think. They just want the job done and they want it done to meet and exceed the key performance indicators. And it can be a bit of a shock. It was a bit of a shock to the system, really, to learn that actually you've got to be a bit brutal and you've got to stand your ground. Otherwise, people walk all over you.
Can we take you right back? Because many of our listeners are teachers and they're really curious about what it was about your schooling that did or didn't bring you to where you are now. So let's do a really simple question. Can you talk to us about a teacher who believed in you, who inspired you, who helped to create the Alfie that we're talking to now?
Yes, definitely. There was an assistant head teacher at my secondary school who put it this way, parents' evening, in year 11, I remember her sitting down with my mum and she said, "Right, Alfie, you're joined by the two most important women in your life. Never forget that." And what she did is, she was my English teacher, but also being the assistant head was had line management responsibility for the year. She did everything in her power to be able to support and to be able to help me. And she, whether that was advocating for me, I mean, in and among other teachers, I've since learned that she actually sent teachers away from me that wanted to, because I got involved with a lot of extracurricular at school, and I never said no, as it were. And she used to say no on my behalf, and I didn't learn that until I'd left. You know, she was always there for me, always had the time to talk through anything. And you know, what she identified was that what was more important to me was to learn those skills I said earlier about, you know, leadership, about helping people, about, you know, navigating situations more than working out how to, well, for English, what a certain type of sentence is. And she sort of facilitated that, and she helped that growth from sort of year 9 right through to year 11, and that was really important.
Does she know about your successes now, Alfie? Are you still in touch with her?
Yeah, we keep in regular touch.
I love that.
Which is really good. And also I was sort of slightly unwell during year 11. I had what's called ME or CFS, whereby basically my battery, as it were, would drain really quickly. So I had to do sort of half days and a slightly odd timetable. And, you know, there were questions of whether or not actually I'm going to be able to sit all my exams. So for us on the results day to be able to say, I've managed to pass every GCSE. It was a massive achievement for us. Genuinely think that it was only done because of a result of her work and you know, my learning support team.
And when you ask young people, as I was yesterday, I work with some extremely vulnerable young people, when you ask them about what makes a good teacher, actually the answer is often really simple. It's just someone who listens.
Yeah. Exactly,
I was talking to a little boy yesterday who said, I couldn't eat at lunchtime because it was too noisy. So they found me a table away from everyone else so I could eat there. Mm-hmm. And it's those reasonable adjustments. And I know, Alfie, that, you know, people listening might be thinking, goodness, this guy has just sailed through every element of his study and life. Would that be a fair thing to say, Alfie? Are you someone who's sailed through?
No, I don't think so. I actually don't. I think that the people see press releases, they see articles, they see op-eds, they see whatever, and they don't actually see, whether it's in business, they don't see the hard work or the sleepless nights, the crying to friends that goes into it. They don't see in school, they didn't see the conversations that I was having with that assistant head teacher about, you know, life's just too much right now. They don't know my background, and sometimes if someone says to me, oh yeah, but you get everything handed to you on a plate. Oh, no, sorry. You know, I take the mantra that I actually think one of my top qualities is being able to match the energy of a situation, of a person, of a room. If that means being sad, that means being sad. If that means being really happy, that means being really happy. That means if you're being a dickhead, I'll be a dickhead back. It's trying to, because I think it's very British of everybody to not want to triumph and talk all about our successes. But at the same time, I want you to know that actually this hasn't come as a result of mummy and daddy. This has come as a result of hard work and grit and support from fantastic people.
It sounds like you were sort of indicating there that there have been some really troubling and tricky times as you've navigated your way through that. And linking back to what you were saying about soft skills, is there something in there that schools need to be doing way more in terms of supporting the mental health of young people, projecting that much more balanced view about it's okay to not be okay, or are we getting that right?
I think that... I spent a lot of time in secondary school being the student voice, whether that was as formally as head boy in year 11 or, you know, just being known for being able to get on well with teachers, but also getting on well with students, almost acting a bit like a translator between the student and teacher sort of community. And one of the things that always used to come through was that SLT or, you know, other teachers may make a decision and may think that that's in the best interest, but they haven't considered that the tweaking, for example, the colour codes on an end of year report, they may think that makes no difference and may make their spreadsheet look a bit prettier. But actually now seeing lots of red and orange rather than light blue, dark blue on a report, for example, really small thing had a big impact on a lot of students, especially those that were sort of getting grade 7 and 8s that were, you know, fantastic results. But if that was not showing as, you know, a green on their report, you know, yeah, exactly. If that wasn't on track for the flight path model to take off at Heathrow in the summer, then that was, you know, terrible. But in terms of, to answer your question again, because I've done this wonderful thing where I can ramble.
No, but I think you're right.
Yeah, So to answer your question, it's okay. What can involve your students a hell of a lot more. Yeah. And actually, okay, yeah, sure. You might have, you said we did posters, right? But what did we say that you didn't do? And why are you not being held accountable to it? I remember at FE, and we'll no doubt get on to what happened there, but I wanted to run this event whereby it was an open forum with the principal in the lecture theatre hall, you know, a bit like a town hall type environment where they were actually taking questions from students and directly answering it, because I felt that the senior leadership team there, right up until you caused a little bit of, you know, something to spin their heads, they weren't interested and they were very much, you know, I'm the chief executive of this place as opposed to the principal of, you know, you're running it like a business rather than a school. Yeah. And ultimately a school or an education environment will not succeed and will fail without getting the support of everybody involved, whether that's teachers or students.
And I tell you, there's something so interesting there, Alfie, because Emma and I both hold very different roles at the moment in very different schools. And playing devil's advocate, I'm looking at that slightly from SLT point of view in terms of, yeah, but if my flight path doesn't look right and the colours aren't right, I'm going to get it in the neck. But actually, you've gone to the key point here, which is that we're here to serve young people and children, not spreadsheets. But Emma, I don't know if you've got a thought on that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to ask Alfie, actually, you know, this is a precious opportunity to get it from the horse's mouth. What can teachers do better after hearing what you've just told us? What can we do better?
I think I think that there's a lot of young people, a lot of teachers that are scared to know. I think they're either scared because it's going to generate more workload for them, or they're scared that they're going to, you know, we're going to think that they're bad teachers or something. Mm. And actually, you're not a bad teacher at all. You're a best teacher when you are best engaging and best serving your students. I remember my favourite, most memorable and best delivered lesson in secondary school was a science lesson by a cover teacher who, well, she was the head of department, but cover in the class. And she had been left by the ordinary teacher a lesson which we had already been delivered, and you know, I think the class teacher had to go because of a family emergency, so it was all very last minute, very understandable. The class didn't get angry about the fact that the hod was trying to deliver a lesson we've already had before. We said it, and then all of a sudden that head of department on their feet completely changed and completely delivered a whole different lesson that was supporting, you know, because she said, okay, right, out of this, because we're coming up to the unit, what have you struggled with most? Here's some revision. Let's do some games. Let's have some activities on our feet. You know, yeah. That was planned, devised, delivered live. And to me, that still remains the best lesson I've ever had, despite there being probably no lesson plan, no PowerPoint, nothing else. Because it was that ability to adapt, that ability to interact and to ultimately engage and be interested in what the young people needed to know.
See, that's brilliant, because I'm sitting here thinking through my 23-year career and how many Alfies have I taught, and obviously you are entirely unique. But actually, Alfies weren't always very easy to teach, because they told you what they really thought.
Yeah.
And actually, sometimes that was really hard to hear. And I've got a certain young lady in my head who really, really took me to task on the way I was teaching a certain unit of the French GCSE and said, no, miss, it's boring, it's tedious, I'm frustrated, I don't like French anymore. And that was really hard to hear. And then I sat down with her and said, well, how would you do it? What do you suggest?
Yeah.
After my ego had recovered and I'd licked my wounds. And she had some brilliant ideas, and we ended up doing an investigation into how many tenses exist in the French language compared to how many tenses exist in English, which sounds as exciting as you reading GDPR documents, but actually got really exciting. And she really probably developed me more as a teacher than any line manager coming to offer me a good or outstanding or requires improvement grading. So students like you make teachers listen, which I think is really powerful.
I think it's a question of making heads turn. And they always, I remember it. I had a friend that always used to say, yeah, but nobody listens to me. I'm just sort of blurred into the background. Yeah. Because I'm not a troublemaker and I'm not a high attainer. And actually it turned out that she was one of the, because we had a very excellent, again, goes back to fantastic teachers. My head of year was also my IT teacher. At GCSE, and me, this girl, and him were having this discussion, and then he said, "No, actually, I try my hardest to engage and listen to everyone. What am I not doing that makes you feel excluded?" And that was powerful, and that was important. And I think it's, if you're able to do everything you can. I mean, it's always important, isn't it, to listen to everyone, but it's never been more important now especially with, you know, as we come back from home learning or whatever, to make sure that everyone feels listened to and that everyone is valued. And that's an incredibly difficult thing to do, because I know that everyone that goes on the student council, everyone that stands up for election in you know, schools and stuff, are very similar personalities, very similar backgrounds most of the time. And so it can be hard for school leaders to engage with every type of person and every background, but pursue it and keep, try your utmost hardest to do it, because once you do it, once you've got that data, you'll never be more thankful.
Yeah. And Alfie, we've heard some good stories there from you about HODs and SLT who did listen and did act. I'm going to pull the thread now on the FE story, because I'd rather get the sense it was a slightly different picture.
Well, Alfie left, didn't he? So I was Alfie's coach, and we started off saying, should he stay at school? How can he balance his studies with his business? And then by the time we got to our third coaching session, Alfie had gone. So there's impact from a coach. So go on. Tell us the story. So dish the dirt.
I think it's important that obviously most of the time FE providers are able to provide a fantastic experience for many young people, and they, whether it's a sixth form, whether it's a technical college, many young people enjoy it, and it's the time that they discover the subjects they are truly passionate about. And I had done that. I had discovered the subject I was truly passionate about. However, I had discovered it outside of the FE environment because of lockdown and because of the coincidence that building the business presented. And I got to the point where actually I didn't feel I was doing either thing amazingly. I wasn't putting 100% into either college or the business, and things were starting to you know, turn down a little bit. And so I went to my tutor, who was also, again, the course leader. Not, yeah, so it's slightly different than FE, isn't it? I think they were my course leader. And then he sort of engaged in a conversation as well with the faculty head. And what I wanted to basically do is the portfolio that we've generated at work and the projects that I've personally worked on, I wanted to use as coursework material, because I was doing a BTEC in media production, and I felt that was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, because what you're basically doing is I literally said that here's your assignment brief with your logo on, here's our client brief with our logo on. It's basically the same thing, except for the fact that we've done it for a fashion brand and you want us to do it for a window cleaner, you know? And so to me, it was a fairly logical thing to do. And they said, well, no. And I said, why not? And these conversations continued, and I got a fantastic sentence out of them that said, never in a million years would we look to adapt or suit our courses to suit individual students' requirements. They said that it would be, down to too much work for them to do to mark a different type of assignment, even though it was. And they said that this was a fun one. I was studying a BTEC. They said it was in and against the BTEC guidelines. I used my network to contact somebody high up in Pearson, who said, "No, that's absolutely perfectly fine. I'm happy to explain that to them." And it just got to the point where, again, to go back to the diplomatic business term, we felt that we had got as much out of the relationship as we were going to do. And I felt it was in my best interest to just walk away.
So in terms of, I speak as the eternal student, so I've studied for probably a total of about 12 years. Do you think that's the end of the road for you in terms of study? Are you a business, an entrepreneur, or whatever you want to call it? Is this it now? Is this the end of the road for you in terms of studying under lecturers or teachers?
I'd quite like to get a doctorate just so I can beat my mother to it, because she's been doing studying for many years. But no, I think
you just want to be Dr. Payne, don't you?
I think I should
Dr.
make it.
Payne.
I think I'd make a great dentist. Yes, Dr. Payne, we'll see you now.
Run screaming from the room.
No, I think there's time and place for learning and for education, and I think getting the formal qualifications. Probably I may well go back to the Open University and especially study things surrounding, you know, psychology, sociology, and the sort of leadership side of things. But right now I think the focus has to be on stabilizing what I've grown over the last year. For sure. I think I have loved education. I love learning. But I don't think a break is necessarily a bad thing from it.
It's safe to say I've never felt more like such a woeful underachiever. When I reflect on what I was like at 18, I was definitely not setting up award-winning businesses, that's for sure.
No, when I was 18, I thought I knew absolutely everything and then very quickly realized that I knew absolutely nothing. I was definitely a communist, though. I was a communist when I was 18, and I knew for certain that communism was the way forward. Very impressive young man indeed. But actually, yeah. What came through is that actually he's faced a number of struggles as well, and the role of the school in being there or indeed not for him has really left its mark.
A lot of our school communities will have been through the most torrid of times in the last year. And I think what we need to do as educators is make sure that we are fully set up with solutions, with ideas to be forward thinking, but responsive to what's happening in front of us.
Absolutely. But it's also, I mean, it's the idea of loss extends a lot further, doesn't it? We've been doing a lot of training in my local area with teachers on loss and trauma and bereavement. And it's not just that people will have lost loved ones to COVID or to other causes. It's also that so much else has been lost.
Time,
you know, our daughter
freedom.
Said the other day, it's all the learning with none of the fun. Time, freedom, sports, you know, a lot of just that human contact, you know, I mean, as we talked about earlier, the noise of just being back in school again, the bustle, the intensity is a lot. So it's how we, you know, what tips can we give to teachers to practically support young people? Because we can't assume anything, can we?
No, we can't. And in fact, that's one of my biggest mantras this time, reopening mark 17,452, like it feels like sometimes, is not assuming which children will be wobbly, which staff won't be wobbly, who's experienced what. We had very fixed mindset, I think, around that before. These children will have had a dreadful time. And actually, some of them loved being at home. And so it's about having an open mind, an open heart, open eyes and open ears, and just waiting to find out rather than make assumptions. That's been a huge one for me, for sure. What about you?
Yeah, well, that links right back to what Alfie says, doesn't it? You know, that common theme of if you ask any child what makes a good teacher, it's somebody who actually listens. And that one of my favorite classroom activities, and I love it because it's simple, is the I wish my teacher knew, or things I wish my teacher knew. And working in the Pru as I do, I've had the luxury of one-on-one or very small groups, and I've sat down with the children and actually had a chance to say to them, you know, this is your chance, you tell me.
And for bigger classes, how can we do that? What good solutions are there that people can take away from that?
Oh, it's really simple. It's the best activity in the world. You just write on the board, I wish my teacher knew. Give them a piece of paper. Give them an option as to whether they wish to be anonymous or not. Mm. I mean, I've had some of the most powerful things come out of that, from a child coming out as gay to, you know, a child letting me know their parents are splitting up, to a child saying, I love your lessons because, you know. So actually, just quite simply, if you're seeing your children back for the first time or the second or third time, it doesn't matter. Just giving them that piece of paper and saying, this is your chance to tell me the truth. And taking those bits of paper away and reading, and you will be delighted. You will have your heart broken. But it will help you build that relationship with your class so much more effectively.
I think then it's keeping it going. So we've got, in all of our classrooms, we've got a box where children can write things where they want to celebrate stuff, either about themselves or each other. But there is also a jar in each classroom that says, I wish my teacher knew. So you can start the activity if you've not done it before, but then just leave those boxes there for the rest of time, because the children do need that outlet, and some won't be able to say it. But if they know they can write it at any time and leave it in there, that's a really powerful message that your ears are always open.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes back again to your not assuming everything. You know, I was talking to a head of year the other day who said that the pack has completely been shuffled. Yeah, a lot of children who might, for example, have been very happy at home have really struggled to come back. And let's not forget, when they came back after the summer, they'd had a summer holiday. Many had actually managed to go away. There'd been that, you know, it was a natural return to school. It was the September return to school, and there was that wonderful honeymoon period. This time we've gone from pretty much overnight online teaching, which we've talked about for all its ludicrousness, straight back into the classroom, back into school uniform, back into checking equipment, back into setting the alarm probably for 2 hours earlier than normal. So it's been a lot more stark, I think, a lot more shocking, this transition.
It has. And I think the other takeaway solution I'd be offering colleagues who are listening or parents who are listening is stripping everything right back to the bare essentials. And we've talked a lot about that in my schools. It's just everything you thought you planned, reduce it by 50% and build in time to settle into classroom routines, time to talk, time to get used to writing again that's not on an iPad, just time and focusing on those big rocks and everything else will come, because if we rush this, we won't be able to rebuild it again.
I love your big rocks. And our producers just got in touch on the message box to say, it's a shame we can't do the reverse. I wish my students knew. And
yes.
Actually, why on earth not? And I'm not an advocate of oversharing with students, but actually allowing them to know that you're human.
Yeah.
Allowing them to know that your cat died, for example, and you're feeling really sad about it.
Yeah.
Why on earth not? Why on earth not? It's those relationships that need to be reestablished.
It's
those
role modeling.
Roots that need to be nurtured. Yeah,
it is.
And it's role modeling
of saying, I wish my students knew that I was a bit nervous on Monday, but actually within 10 minutes, the world felt wonderful again. Or I wish my students knew that I was over the moon to see them and it was the very best day. It's just sharing and role modeling your own mental health and discussions, I think, can be quite healthy if it's done in a sensible, measured way.
So much to learn there from Alfie. So wonderful to have a fresh young voice on our podcast. And yes, lovely to take those ideas forward.
Thank you so much for joining us. And as ever, pick up the conversation. Let us know what you wish your students knew. Let us know some brilliant solutions you've trialled in your classroom and we can pick it up next time.
Absolutely. See you next time.
The Clem & M podcast, presented by Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Produced by Ravvat Garma. The Clem & M podcast is a Those That Can production.